Welcome to the podcast called The Battle for African Agriculture, a space where we challenge dominant narratives and imagine just sustainable futures, especially when it comes to food and farming in Africa. Today we are joined by Peter Goebbels, a longtime advocate for food sovereignty and agroecology in West Africa. Based in Ghana, Peter was serving as the Director of Research and Advocacy for Grounds Trade International in the Sahel, where he's worked closely with communities across the region for over two decades. His work focuses on grassroots resilience, ecological restoration, and challenging the structural roots of hunger and poverty, many of which are tied to the legacies of colonialism and ongoing neocolonial influences. Peter, we're thrilled to have you with us today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for the invitation. Thank you.
Peter, by the way, I would love to say that, you know, Peter is one of the, you know, the people that I respect here in Africa. You're giving quite a lot to the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa, to our collective struggle. And we all appreciate what you are doing. Peter,
well, I'm just happy that
yourself.
Okay.
Yes.
Well,
yeah.
I guess the main thing I should say is that I grew up on a farm. My father was a farmer. My grandfather was a farmer. And he felt very strongly that farming was the best life for any for all of his sons. He had six boys, two girls. I'm the eldest. And it was always my intention to become a farmer. And I went, after finished high school, I went to agricultural school. And then my dad said, great, now, Peter, you are ready to come back home and help me on the farm. But I knew what farming is like. You know, you don't have any vacation time. You have to look after the cattle. It's you have no time to do anything. And I had never traveled. I'd always been either on the farm or at school. So I said to my dad that, you know, Dad, I'd like to see a little bit part of the world before I come home and farm with you. So I joined a volunteer agency, and they posted me to a church-related agriculture project here in northern Ghana. And that was in 1978.
Wow.
And that was the beginning of my journey. And I was only supposed to stay for 2 years, but then that 2 years turned into 4 years. And then in the third year, I met my wife, who is from Ghana. And to make the long story short, we were married and in 1981. And eventually we built a house in near her village where she was born. And the elders of her village and her gave us some land, and we are doing some farming. And altogether, I have lived and worked for more than 32 years in West Africa, not always in Ghana, but in Togo, in Burkina Faso, in other countries. I've worked in six or seven different countries here in West Africa. So that is a bit of my background. And I should mention that my dad was disappointed I never came back home. But I realized that in Canada, you know, I could go back and help my dad grow more wheat and more corn and more soybeans, or I could be here helping farmers, small-scale farmers, to learn how to be more sustainable and improve their production. And that seemed to be a more appealing, yeah, I'll use the word vocation, than going back home, especially since in Canada, the type of farming there became more and more, you know, more big machinery, lots of money you have to spend, going into debt with the bank and buying chemicals. And that wasn't, I became more and more disenchanted with that approach to farming. So even though I still have some brothers and cousins who are doing that, but that is a bit of my backstory, Million.
You must have been learning also from African agriculture. It's a cross.
Well, I had to learn a lot. I had to learn a lot since I was here. It wasn't Canadian style farming at all. No.
As you said, you worked in Sahel for many years. From your perspective, how do colonial histories shape the region's agriculture, land use, and governance today. By the way, I read somewhere that if you want to imagine the Sahel, it's like that. It's like it's like a beach for the big Sahara Desert. You know, it's just a long beach. That's how they imagined the Sahel somehow. You know, it's just like, it's like the shore of the desert, the Sahara Desert.
Well, that's a myth. It's a misleading characterization of the Sahel. As I think you probably know, many of the most famous and long-term empires that are African states that were located in the Sahel. And it is a vibrant set of communities, has a long history. Timbuktu is in the Sahel, and it was a... Yep. You know, even before Europe, it was a very famous cultural and learning center. It was rich in resources, and there's a long history here. So it is, you know, ecologically, it is grasslands and shrubs and trees. And then as you come further south, you get more forested areas, Guinea savanna and the forested areas near the coast. So I just want to disabuse you of billowing sand dunes and all of that. You have to go much further north to see that. And I was surprised when I was in Ghana and I first visited, you know, further north in the Sahel. I said, how can you grow crops here? And I was just seeing millet, you know, growing, you know, 500 miles north of where I was in Ghana. So I learned a lot about the Sahel. But to your question... when I first came to Ghana, it was not immediately apparent to me, Million, since I was brand new to the area, how colonialism had affected farming. I knew about colonialism and I knew about independence and all the, you know, the ways that colonialism had had affected the, you know, everything from exploitation, extraction of mineral wealth and timber and all of that. But I did not really know about how it affected farming. And that came gradually. And here are the main ways that colonial administration affected agriculture in the Sahel. And the way that peasant farmers produced food for many generations, for centuries in the Sahel. First, colonial administration put emphasis on monoculture and cash crops. So this gives you an example, cotton in Burkina Faso and Mali. We still grow a lot of cotton in those countries. And then peanuts in the Senegal, the peanut basin. Those were just examples of how colonial administrators obliged farmers to shift away from their local crops, food crops, and produce crops that were really meant for export and to fuel the colonial economy and the motherland, the colonial states in Europe in particular. And this disrupted many of the traditional farming systems that were quite resilient, and I'll talk more about that if you wish, that really had existed for centuries, that were sustainable. And the way that farmers were persuaded, like, let's use that word, I think the better word is forced, is they had to pay taxes. And the colonial powers made traditional chiefs, you know, the traditional chiefs in direct rule, they made them the chief tax collectors. And you had to use pay in taxes in the not in local currencies that existed, but in Francophone colonies in CFAs, the central Communauté Française. I'm not sure what it stands for anymore, but it's CFA franc. And so you had to. The only way you could get that is by selling crops that were, you know, that colonial powers wanted to buy. So that created a major shift over to monoculture and cash crops. And that had an impact because those crops, if you keep doing them year after year after year, that exhausts the soil. And that because the soil got exhausted, farmers had to clear more land, because if the yields go down, you have to, you know, expand the land under cultivation. And anyway, it led to an undermining and deterioration of local food security and a dependence on imported food crops that came from other places, especially like the main crops here, million are millet and sorghum and cowpeas. And yeah, they're still being grown, but the main crops are the cash crops. Then another impact of colonialism was privatization of land. The Europeans didn't understand, you know, usufruct land use, communal land ownership, and the local institutions that regulated all that. We have something here called land priests that control the land, and it wasn't for sale. There weren't mortgages and so on, but the colonial powers really instituted this privatization of land. Then another aspect, you know, in the Sahel, we have the Fulani, we have the Tuareg that really had extensive and well-developed pastoral livestock keeping. And the Europeans didn't think that was rational. They preferred ranching or sedentary farming, so they really undermined a lot of the pastoral systems. And then, you know, the infrastructure that exists, that was built here during the colonial times, the roads, the ports, and I already mentioned the money systems, all were really set up to facilitate extraction of wealth from farming and also from mining and other and timber and other raw materials. So we had all of that, plus the colonial, you know, they weren't setting up nice, democratic, inclusive governments. It was all very top-down. It was there was a lot of forced labor. And so you had the legacy of the colonial time of top-down, centralized bureaucracies, governments that were set up, and small local elites. And then I've already mentioned that, you know, there was a lot of destruction or undermining of the local farming system. So those are some of the things I learned living here for many years about what happened during the colonial times.
What would you say is the most enduring institutional or ecological scars of colonial rule in the Sahel?
There are many. I'll start with the institutional ones, Megan. First of all, you know, people have this vision that, you know, nothing existed in Africa before. It was just a place where peasant farmers were running around and yeah, there was slavery. Yeah. But there were local institutions. And I've tried to help revalorize and revitalize some of them. And some of these institutions, I've already mentioned traditional chieftaincy. They were in place. I don't want to say that they were all perfect, but you know, they did respond to the needs of their people. There were local empires here, but there are also institutions that dealt with the environment. There are also institutions that dealt with water and land management systems, and those institutions were weakened through the colonial powers. And led to a lot of problems with between ethnic groups as well. Another institution, well, you know, local currency that existed was replaced by European currencies, and the monetary system, especially in the Francophone countries, the CFA franc, that's another institution, was really designed to facilitate extraction and have to pay in the European currency. So that was another one. The trade system, so rather than investing in local production and processing of local food and food sovereignty, the trade system really encouraged, again, extraction and sale of export crops And then that meant you had to import local foods and import European goods, manufactured goods as well. And that was another aspect. Then the land tenure. So there was a lot of privatization of land that I've already mentioned. And that undermined customary rights that provided a lot more land access to ordinary farmers. And then I should also mention that borders, you know, the borders that we have here were not set in stone. They were imposed, I think, in 18, I've forgotten, the Berlin Conference of 1885. I'm not sure if I got the year right.
1884, 1887, I think. People say that they went on for 15 years or something,
And these borders did not, were set up arbitrarily, just some colonial people drawing lines on a map between the French and the Germans and the English and the Spanish and the Portuguese. And I'd, like here, like I take the case of Ghana. Togo was a French colony. The Gold Coast at that time was a British colony. And then after World War One, you know, Germany lost, Togo was a German colony. Germany lost the war. And so the British and the French decided to split up German Togoland into two, a British side and a French side. And then in doing that, all those ethnic groups, the Mina, the Kotokoli, the Basari, the Moba, I can go on, there are others, all were split into two. So one half of those ethnic groups are on the Togolese side, and one half eventually joined the Ghana side. And that's one just example. But more examples are in the north, in the Sahel, where you had the Tuareg and the Fulani, which depended on, you know, long ways of migrating with their, it's called transhumance, with their herds to follow the seasons and where there are pastures. And, you know, their whole livelihood depends on mobility. And it's a very, it's finally being recognized that it's a very effective way of using natural resources. And that's been cut off because of borders that were arbitrarily designed. So those are some of the, and that, by the way, led to conflict because eventually, you know, fighting or conflict over access to water and to land was disrupted, all those patterns that were there before. So those are some of the institutional scars. Then environmental scars, there are also many. I've already mentioned one where farmers had to clear more land, cut down more trees, clear more forests in order to produce more crops, and had to monoculture. They were forced to use these extractive soil depleting crops if you keep growing them year after year. And then the traditional ways of fallowing and agroforestry were reduced. They had to clear more land to that reduced the fallow. And that led to, you know, a decline in soil fertility, and then a decline in soil fertility, less resilience to climate change. And then finally, also, the inability to really produce their own local foods. So let me give you one example, a personal experience I had in Liptugu Department in Burkina Faso. I was doing some, you know, the way that I was working at that time. We were always asking communities what were the problems, what did it look like, you know, 50 years ago. 20 years ago, and that's how I learned a lot of what happened, you know, during the colonial times. And this one old farmer in Liptugu was sitting underneath a big baobab tree, and he said, you know, you see this land in front of you? And I said, yes. It was all barren, completely barren. And he said, when I was a small boy, he was, I don't know how old he was, you know, the they don't have birth certificates in the days that he was born. He said, this was forest, and we would be scared to go at night into the forest because of the animals, the wild animals. And I couldn't believe it. You know, that land, all barren, and denuded and eroded. And he said it was all forest. I could hardly believe. And yet I confirmed this with other people. This was the transformation that happened in many parts of the Sahel. You don't see it if you just come for 1 or 2 years, you know, like a lot of consultants do. But if you ask around and know about the history, there's been a very substantial degradation of the of the natural resource space in terms of animals, biodiversity, trees, and the land itself has become as I heard many people say, tired.
Yeah.
So that's. That's a bit of the ecological scars that are still persisting to this day, Million.
Thank you so much. Wow. Yeah, so many things you've said. So how did colonial administrations transform or distort traditional food systems? And how do those effects persist in present-day policy and practice? By the way, we're not talking about the past now. We're talking about the present, you see. People should differentiate between the past and present. When we are talking about colonialism, we're not talking about things of the past. We still have the scars, you know, what you have pointed really. So, how did they transform or distort the traditional food systems, and how do those effects persist in present-day policy and practice?
Well, current day, when these different countries in the Sahel and West Africa became independent, they inherited quite centralized, top-down governance structures, and they maintained them. And they inherited economies that were really based on extraction. And they more or less, not completely, but those patterns persisted. And this continued to disrupt indigenous agricultural practices, and it continued to change diets, you know, because if you produce more cash crops, you produce less local food. And guess what were the main imports? It was rice, there was wheat. You know, a lot of people here eat wheat, you know, the French like their bread. And you still see a lot of that. So what the pre-colonial farming systems, they were diverse crops. They were drought-resistant crops like millet and sorghum that were suited to the local agroecology and cowpeas. Cowpeas originated in West Africa. There was agropastoralism. There was intercropping. There was rotation. There was agroforestry. They let certain types of trees grow, especially the Fiderbia albida, that was really, you know, a leguminous crop that loses its leaves in the off season and fertilizes the soil. And all of that was disrupted. And now you see here in Ghana, for example, many more still persistent of cash crops. And there are new ways that this modern agriculture in post-colonial times have persisted. And people still need cash, you know, for school fees and for health fees and so on. So they still tend to grow cash crops. And you see a lot of introduction of maize being pushed by governments. And maize, you know, is an exhausting crop, and you need fertilizer in order for it to do well. So there's a lot of fertilizer subsidies. And then a lot of the so-called improved varieties need chemicals and pesticides like cowpeas. And so you still see, like even Senegal today, it's supposed to be one of the ones that are promoting agroecology, but they still want to produce peanuts in the peanut basin. And that requires a lot of fertilizer. I don't know what percentage of the overall budgets of Ghana and Senegal go to subsidizing fertilizer, because fertilizer is too expensive for farmers to buy. And they provide it either on credit or subsidize it or both. So you have a lot of that. And then you see, like here, a change in dietary preferences. So, you know, this is complex. There are a lot of changes going on at the same time. You know, people want convenience. But when I came to Ghana in 1978, when I ate the local food, the basic food is called sabo, or TZ in Tonzafi in Hausa. It is made from, TZ. And the local word here is sabo in my wife's language. It is made from millet, or it is made from sorghum. And the the purple type of sorghum, not the improved type, you know, the tall one that bends down. And that was just, people said that rice is like, in French you say amuse-gueule. It's just like a snack, you know, something you do during the Islamic festivals. You didn't really eat unless you ate sab with local sauce, of course. And now you see, even in my own wife's village, it's hard because I grow sorghum. Well, I grow, my extended family grows sorghum and millet, but everybody's growing maize. And the tastes have shifted away from sorghum and millet to maize. And maize flour is not at all as nutritious as sorghum or millet, and it's less diverse and requires inputs. But people, even my sisters-in-law and their households, they only eat maize sabo. So that's just an example of the decline of indigenous crops. I can mention quite a few crops like bambara beans, fonio, yams, cassava. They're not grown in any quantity, or they're only starting to come back. And there are other ones. Pesa is a type of local potato in the language here in Ghana. And those have been in decline. There's been no research, no support for them. And yet they're much more suited to the local environment because they evolved over generations. So that's another aspect of how, now the persistence comes because we still have the need for cotton and the need for peanuts, and here in Ghana, cocoa. And there are global market pressures. Like, these countries have been integrated into the global financial system, trade, neoliberal system, which is that you produce what you can sell on the international market. That's your comparative advantage. So that's pineapple, and that's cocoa, and that's peanuts. And then we'll send you our processed goods, or we'll send you our subsidized food, you know? Wheat, and that comes in the form of food aid and other things. So, and then you have another phenomenon, which I think we're going to talk more about, is that multinational food corporations want to sell their seeds. They want to sell their chemicals. You know, they're more or less saturated the market in the United States. I think 90% of all food, soybeans and corn in the United States is GMO, which requires glyphosate and all the other chemicals, which are proven more and more to be very terrible for the environment, for human health. And they want to open their markets here. So they're using their pressure and convincing government that's the modern way to farm, you know, and governments are listening, and they are spending a lot of money subsidizing fertilizer, because without fertilizer, these crops can't grow. So you have those types of pressures that are causing persistence of, you know, so why didn't it all go back to traditional ways after independence? But I've given you some of the reasons why it did not. And then one other thing is, I'm not sure if you or your listeners have heard about structural adjustment and the World Bank. That would happen in the 80s and 90s when I was here, and I've seen those programs, which removed a lot of supports that were already still in place despite, you know, colonialism for small-scale farmers, and that was ended, and even food reserves were ended to help us be more resilient against drought and other things. And there was a more of a push for commercial agriculture, get big or get out, you know, that type of thinking. And the small scale farmers, the peasant farmers, they are not viable, so they have to leave eventually. And agribusiness thinking really came into being more and more during the independent post-colonial times. So those are some of the reasons why the farming system continued to persist after to the present day after colonialism.
Thank you so much. Many argue that the development in the Sahel is still externally driven. How do you see modern aid, development programs, or climate finance repeating colonial patterns?
Well, I've already mentioned this a bit, Million. There are many what I would call false solutions. The biggest false solution is the Green Revolution. You know, I've been in Ghana now since 1978, and I think I've seen three different waves of trying to promote the Green Revolution. One of them was the Sasakawa initiative back in the 80s or so. That was financed by Japan and to try to promote. And it was always the same pattern, you know, improved seeds, fertilizer, tractor services, and modern, you know, so-called modern agriculture. And now there's a more recent iteration, which is also failing, which is promoted by the Gates Foundation through the entity called AGRA, Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. This is the thinking, you know, we need to import the industrial Green Revolution model. And there's a lot of money, international organizations, you know, all those consultants and often well-intentioned people, that they're all had their schooling in agriculture in the United States, many of them, or in Europe. And that's the way they think is the way forward for Africa. And so I see here, like, to make it, you know, a very nuanced and complex situation a bit more clear, two pathways. One is the industrial Green Revolution pathway, and the other one is the agroecological pathway. Agroecology doesn't have all the solutions yet. You know, we have to replace many farms that become dependent on fertilizer and on cash crops and so on. So there's still a lot to be done. We can't go back to the way it was, you know, 100 years ago. But should we go further into highly fossil fuel oriented or dependent industrial agriculture, that model, which I would claim is causing massive problems? The Green Revolution then documented in India, where it really took hold, and in the United States in terms of environment, in terms of food security, in terms of food, not security, but diets and so on, and highly processed foods. Now they're wanting to say, well, you know, those problems exist, but we can fix it. Techno fixes, more false solutions. So we can have drones, and we can have precision agriculture. We can have digitalized agriculture. Those are the things. And then we can have climate resistant or drought resistant seeds. You know, we can tweak the seeds. So more GMOs, more high-tech external inputs, more types of chemicals. And I see that as still, you know, modern aid and thinking still being quite strong. And again, under the USAID, in many cases, have been influenced by corporate interests to push their products and their chemicals and their seeds. So I see that. And that's has been reinforcing dependency. And aid supports that, because aid, while it's changing now, they're shifting more to cash. But still, food aid, I know, especially in the 90s and so on, when there were the droughts, and then in the 80s when there were the droughts, they're bringing all this cheap corn or cheap wheat from the United States. Well-intentioned, I suppose, but it undermined... Let me give you an example. I had to do a research sort of assignment in Chad about food security, and it was an international organization, and they were saying, "Well, how well did we do with our emergency program?" And what I found out was that there was a big surplus of food in the south of Chad, in the Saar region, and They had difficulty getting up to N'Djamena in the northern part that was affected by the drought. So they went through Cameroon, and they couldn't sell their surplus. So they went into Cameroon and were selling it in Cameroon At the same time, in the north, there was a drought and a lack of food. And you had all this food aid trucks coming in through the UN and through these international organizations coming north. So you had the ironic situation of trucks with full of Chadian grain, local grains going south for sale in Cameroon, bypassing trucks going north with food aid. Now, that's just an example. It's a real example of the crazy situation where, you know, policies are working against local food sovereignty and making best use of our resources and internal trade. So I'm just giving you some examples.
Yeah, it's excellent. Thank you so much. But
One more point.
Okay, you go.
Is about something I'm part of the Evergreening Alliance, the Global Alliance, Evergreening Alliance, and I'm having a lot of, what should I say, not conflict, but critical concerns with them, because they are looking for carbon credits to finance, you know, because governments are in debt and they're looking for money, and this has happened in Southern Africa and Kenya. They see, you know, if we keep our forests in place or we plant more trees, we'll get money. And we're not going to get grants. We're not going to get, you know, anyway, I could go on and on about that. But I think that that's another potential wrong solution or false solution about selling biodiversity credits or carbon credits. Maybe the Global Evergreen Alliance can find a way to make it work. I'm waiting to see if that can happen and prevent, you know, all the negative things that have happened. But that's another one that's happening. I just want to bring it to your attention and that of your listeners.
No, excellent. Thank you so much. But you have answered this question to some extent, but I just wanted you to focus on the power dynamics, you know. To what extent do current market-based or technical solutions to hunger and desertification desire reproduce all the power dynamics?
Well, you know, I always try to be, you know, look at things objectively, and I don't take a polemic or very strong. In USAID, it's clear that they are influenced by a lot of their agricultural development programs have been influenced by the corporate sector in their own country. But they have also some good programs, especially in the Sahel, that deal with environmental issues, that deal with resilience, and have recognized that FMNR, farmer-managed natural regeneration of trees and so on, are helpful, that prevention of land erosion through Zai micro water harvesting methods and stone buns can be helpful. And they've been supporting that. But in another place, you know, they are doing harm. And another example, there's a story. This has not happened, a story to me personally, but it's a story that I've been making rounds in Ghana. This is when the German Ghanaian Agriculture Development Project was running in the 90s. You have two Germans coming into running into each other in a small bar in a small town. And the one guy says, "Oh, you're working for the German Agricultural Development Program?" I said, "Yeah, what do you do?" "Oh, we are trying to help farmers to plant trees and do agroforestry." "And what do you do?" And the other guy says, "Well, we are clearing land to plant rice plantations." And they're working in the same area. So you have conflicting priorities even within the same aid agencies. But that's a true story. Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's true, but it's a story that I heard. But and I've seen it. I've seen the rice fields, and I also seen the agroforestry work. But the main ways that institutions like the World Bank and the Agricultural Development Bank, African Development Bank, I don't want to forget them, and European bilateral donors, you know, even though some of their work they're doing is good and there's some shifts, overall, if you look at where their money goes, it goes still for green revolution. I'm sorry, the agroecology work, there have been some studies done, I think by IPES Food, you're a member of that, and Grain, to look at what is the percentage of aid that goes to agroecology. It's minuscule. It's minimal. And so that's the aid goes to, you know, in more of the Green Revolution type of thinking, which is chemical fertilizers, seed subsidies. And then you have GMO patented seeds, and they're trying to use the protocol for harmonizing seeds, even criminalizing farmers that use local seeds or exchange local seeds. I could talk a lot about that. That's happening in Ghana and Kenya and other places. So, and then there's a push for, there's another major way, convincing governments through subsidized fertilizers. There's a huge fertilizer subsidy program here in Ghana, in other places as well, through, you know, for cotton and for peanut production, it's subsidized fertilizer. And then you have land grabbing. Mali, which is supposed to be, you know, more ecologically oriented, even there, you had huge parts of the Niger Delta, which is good for rice production. 100,000 hectares, I think, was the amount that was given to Libya. You know, because Libya doesn't have enough food. So I think Gaddafi was still in power at that time. So I'm going back a ways. And that's land grabbing. And then you have in Senegal, the whole rich place that I think some Italian or Norwegian company also taking over lots of land. So you have a lot of this land grabbing. Here in Ghana, there was biofuels from, what's that crop again that that produces oil, industrial oil? I've forgotten the name of it. That was being promoted. No, the name escapes me. Sorry for the moment. It's it grows a bit like cassava. It's but it's an oil. It produces oil.
It's castor. Castor, no.
Well, that's not the one. It's similar, but it's not the one. But anyway, it to produce oil or on a massive industrial scale through plantations. So you have, and then you have mango orchards and so on that are, you know, set up for European export, pineapples and papaya. So, and then, of course, cocoa is still there. So all of that is still ways. And then I already mentioned the carbon offset projects. So you have all of those methods that...
is it the Jatropha?
Then, Jatropha, thank you. My mind, I couldn't get the name. You know, I'm getting a bit older, Million. Sometimes names escape me. And then, you know, there's something that you are familiar with because you've written, or EPES Food has written in, lock-ins. There are a lot of lock-ins, the existing infrastructure, existing ways of working, the existing power structure, lock in the current patterns. And it's very hard to overcome those, you know? And I won't go through, there's 8 lock-ins. But the problem with agroecology is that it's context specific. Like if you have seeds or fertilizer, that you can do that across a whole region. But for agroecology, it has to be very contextualized, very, you know, adapted to local farming systems. And it doesn't give a quick return on investment. If you invest in fertilizer, you get an immediate increase in yield. It doesn't last. It's not sustainable. It deteriorates the environment. It reduces soil fertility, but you get an increase in yield right away. And this is the problem in the thinking is that quick, immediate results, focused on productivity, leaving behind, you know, like an agricultural system, a food and farming system should look at not just productivity, but in terms of resilience to climate change, to sustainability of the natural resource base and soil health in particular. And then also about nutrition, does it foster local diverse diets? But the thinking of the current big projects, irrigation and dams and tractors and subsidies is all green revolution is only on productivity. So those are some of the mechanisms that we have.
Peter, we'll come to that a bit later on you know, the importance of agroecology for the Sahel in particular. But maybe in one or two sentences, how is this agricultural activity, the push for one form of agriculture, reproduces the power dynamics that existed during colonial time.
Well, it is reproduced in many different ways. You have extraction. Let's use that word: extraction of commodities for sale for export crops. That reproduces the colonial time. You have top-down governance models that undermine or don't listen to local traditional institutions. You have cash crop dependency. I've already mentioned that. Focus on large-scale land grabbing. Land grabbing is very much part of the colonial power dynamics. You have the money system and the trade system that work to facilitate extraction and focus natural resources on mining and on other, you know, cobalt and other things that are so popular these days. Gold is a big thing, is very expensive. And rather than on a localized economies, solidarity economies. So, and then you have the urban elites. They've all been trained. Many of the people have been trained in Europe and have absorbed their ways of thinking and consider traditional farming to be outmoded. These narratives that happen, you know, of course, we can't go back 100 years. The population is bigger and things have changed a lot. But still, those same principles of working with nature rather than against nature, and having trees on your land and having rotation, and all those things are not conducive to industrial agriculture. It's one huge field, you know, where the tractor can go. So you have a lot of those governance structures, trade relationships, importation of external inputs, and especially seeds and chemicals, and a narrative where, you know, traditional methods and agroecological principles are seen to be outmoded. And then shift in diets as well. You know, the shift, people now want, you know, convenience foods and easy produce rice fastly cooked rice. So those are some of the dynamics. I don't know if I'm answering your question, Million.
Yeah. No, it is excellent. Excellent. Really, really answering it very, very well. Thank you very much. I think your connection is not very strong or mine. And sometimes you freeze and, you know, what you're saying and your words do not match. So anyway, maybe it's almost close to 1 hour now. So if you could answer the following questions like in a crisp way. You've been a powerful advocate of agroecology for a long time in the Sahel region. What makes agroecology a particularly relevant or transformative approach in this region? You've answered it to some extent, but if you could respond to this question.
Well, let's first be clear with your listeners what agroecology is. It's not just a set of farming practices. It is a farming and food system, and it is a set of practices, but it is also a science, you know, of how to do it and how to work with nature. And we don't have all the solutions for that, but we have many of them. I don't want to say that, in any one place, we know exactly what to do now. It requires co-learning and co-design of agricultural development, and that is often neglected. And that it needs it to highly, multi-actor platforms to identify the problems with farmers and work with farmers to find solutions that build on their local knowledge. And then it's a movement. It's a social movement. Mm-hmm. And I think that is underemphasized. How do we work with farmers' organizations, cooperatives, women's groups to promote agroecology as an alternative to the false solutions that I've just been describing. And I see agroecology as having many strengths. One, it is is low cost. You don't have to depend on external inputs as much. Two, and maybe it takes more labor. Okay, and I'm not saying that I'm against any type of appropriate technology that will, you know, reduce labor, but not massive tractors and combines of the industrial type. Yeah. Then it is adapting. You know, we talk about climate change, temperature changes. I asked people, I said, okay, people think about climate change in terms of not enough rainfall, but that's not so much the problem as temperature increases. And what is the technology that will deal with temperature increases and over, you know, heat? And it's not drought resistant seed because that deals with drought. It is, I think, growing crops under dispersed shade, which can be done through agroecology. And so it helps deal with climate change. And then resilience in terms of diverse crops, not putting all your effort and money and buying external inputs on one cash crop, which could fail. And I know farmers who had tears in their eyes when they had to sell their, you know, their inputs or their their whatever crops they produced to pay off their debts. So agroecology, and then soil without soil, you know, we don't have a future. And I talked to one lady who now is doing this type of, you know, setting up a program to find out how were things like in Kaffrine in Senegal. And she said it very succinctly. She said, our soils are dead. Our soils are dead. And we have to revitalize and find ways of restoring soil health. So those are some of and agroecology does that. Green Revolution works the opposite way. It exhausts soils. So those are some of the main reasons and working with trees and working with local resources and integrating synergies with livestock and manure and compost. All of those things, I could go on, you know, and on, but there are many principles and many practices that put together in the right way over the right time can really transform the farming system to be sustainable, resilient, productive, and nutrition sensitive.